Welcome to this week's Third Opinion Podcast. This week we have a story about a controversial Jewish holiday that most people don't even know about. Then in the celebration of the 78th anniversary of the ending of World War II in Europe, we have an emotional piece about what the GIs discovered as they saw the horrors of the concentration camps. Lorene and I debate George Soros, and we disagree, and we have so much more. And don't forget, you can get your third opinion wherever you download your podcasts. And now, this week's Third Opinion Podcast. Good afternoon, or good morning, or good evening, whenever you're listening to this. This is the Third Opinion, Two Jews, Three Opinions on WKDW and the podcast. I'm Mike Deason.
I'm Lorene Jaffe.
Lorene, we got a lot of stuff in today's show about a holiday that very few Jews may know about that takes place in Israel. We'll get that a little bit later on. And then one of the most moving pieces I have seen about the Holocaust, because World War II ended 78 years ago this month, at least the European thing, and the survivors that were found by the soldiers that came in, it shook me. It was so moving. We'll get to that.
Yeah, that piece was from Yad Vashem, which was really an amazing piece. But yeah, there's definitely like a hodgepodge of news this week. So I mean,
we have a lot of news. Okay, how about the thing that upset me is more Jewish books have been banned by the Board of Education from Florida.
Yeah, and I don't, you know, that one article you sent me, it didn't say why or what it was.
So yeah, I couldn't figure, but the one about the Shabbat.
Yeah, the one about the Shabbat, it didn't say what the reason was. So I know that there's, you know, within each school district, school boards are looking at the books and different things. So it's hard for me to comment when that happens and why. Now, I do know that there are very valid reasons to pull certain books that are being pulled. I mean, like, you know, I've heard parents read from these books, some of them that are just like, why do we even have ratings for movies like PG-13, PG rated R? I mean, the whole point of that, like sort of looking at this stuff is, you know,
but pulling books about the Holocaust, that makes no sense to me.
Well, I don't know why, you know, again, it's sort of like, what was it about the book? Was it, you know, was it sort of, did it touch on the Holocaust, but then talk about other things or what, you know, because I mean, look, Florida obviously has some of the strongest Holocaust education laws in the nation with mandatory education. It is very well funded by the state of Florida. I mean, the governor just, you know, issued, you know, another tremendous funding to the Florida Holocaust Museum to support education. So I don't really know. I mean,
The history of the Holocaust was one of the books that was rejected.
I don't know why, because I don't know enough about the specific book. Like what was
okay, but here's the deal. I'm a parent, I'm a grandparent. If you don't want your kid to read a book, I'm fine with it. I really am. And if you want to go to the teacher and say, to put some alternative thing, although I think they should learn about history. I think that's crazy not to let your kid learn about it. But don't impose your views on every parent and every kid.
I do disagree with it a little bit. I mean, you're as a parent, you're trusting the school to make smart decisions for your children. And if it's a rated R book and a kid can't even get into a PG-13 movie, why are you letting them read books about masturbation, different things, which is actually a real problem with some of the other kids and some of the stuff that's in the libraries.
Well, now, okay.
On the Holocaust, listen, if somehow, like, let's say, yeah, it's a book.
Would you ban Catcher in the Rye? I mean, this is not a Jewish book, although it was written by a Jewish guy. Would you have banned Catcher in the Rye?
No, but I think it's appropriate for older kids. I mean,
agreed. I mean, it's a classic. It's a classic book.
Right. Which, by the way, like today, they're even trying to ban, you know, the leftists are trying to ban Mark Twain. So, I mean, you know, it's like, which way do you go?
I know, because they use the N word.
I think
that's ridiculous too. I think that's absolutely ridiculous. Right.
I mean, to me, it was emblematic of the time period in which it was wrote, and that situational. You can't fully appreciate the climate of the historical moment that he's trying to portray if certain things aren't in there. So, but again, I don't know. Like, let's say the book titled "History of the Holocaust" actually denies the Holocaust or does something else. Like, I don't know what's in that book. So it's hard for me to comment. Like, because sometimes when I see this, it's like, okay, that's the title of the book, but what is actually the book about? I don't know. So I can't really comment, like, you know, and say, well, this is stupid. Why are you doing this? I think
modern genocide, they were rejected because they were said they were too woke. Yeah. This term woke, that's a made up term to me.
Well, it's not a made up term. I mean, the left is the one who actually created it, because they would use a comment to, like, you know, to people who aren't, you know, far left people or socialists, saying, are you woke?
Yeah, I think it's a stupid term, quite
frankly. I mean, it is a stupid term. I agree. But I guess they're quite, you know, but I don't know what the book talks about. Does it actually deal with the history, or is it dealing with, like, you know, is it like personal, you know, is it fiction story about the Holocaust and someone's life, and then it has other things involved?
My gut tells me that it's just an overreaction by someone. But
I don't know. But I do know that the governor appointed Mike Eagle, who is also the chair of the Florida Holocaust Museum, to oversee the council of Holocaust education in the state, and that they're monitoring all this very closely, and that committee is monitoring very closely. And if there are books on the Holocaust that are being banned that they think shouldn't be, they will make sure that.
I certainly hope so. I think the governor, as you well know, has gone way overboard, and it's going to hurt him. He's not going to get the nomination. He's going to be destroyed when he declares his candidacy.
Right,
and one of my least favorite people in the world will destroy him.
I put out politics. So
yeah, Donald Trump will destroy him, but that's another story. Okay, here's one. You're going to fall off your seat. You ready? I'm going to give praise to two people you know I am not wild about, to Rick Scott and Marco Rubio, who I have no joy in that. But, you know, give the devil his due. If they did something good, they deserve it. And they introduced a legislation that would allow states to disregard or not invest in any organization that is practicing BDS.
Right, the boycott, divestment, and sanction movement, which is, it's economic warfare against Israel, goes to the delegitimization of Israel. It's based on this whole, you know, false ideology that Israel is an apartheid entity, et cetera, et cetera. You know, so I do applaud Senator.
Yeah, well, but even I do. See, I can be fair. I don't like those guys particularly. But that's, you got to give them credit. That's
right,
a good thing.
By the way, I'm proud as a Florida citizen that the two senators from the state of Florida, the two U.S. senators from the state of Florida, are behind this and are promoting this. I mean, that's actually, and I know Governor Rick, when Rick Scott was the governor of Florida, he also supported the legislation within the state. But this is important, you know, as we continue to battle BDS and a lot of the stuff. I mean, I mean, by the way, that ties to this other story. So,
okay, before you get off Rick Scott, I also have to give him one other compliment. When he was governor, and I wasn't a big fan of his.
No.
At every news conference, unless it was, you know, sometimes you have a news conference where there's more than 100 people there, but it was a small news conference, he would walk around, shake your hand, ask you your name. I mean, he had some personality. DeSantis doesn't do that. He doesn't like people. He doesn't like the media. He doesn't have many friends, from what I'm told, and all. So,
oh, for goodness sake, are we going down this again? All right, enough. So let's go to the next thing. So going back to the BDS movement, I mean, this is huge. So this man, he's one of the co-founders of Students for Justice in Palestine, which is just like an oxymoron of a name, because they don't actually.
Oh, this is the crazy. This is a crazy.
About,
this
right,
is a
yeah.
crazy story. Okay, go ahead. Right. I just had to jump in there. It is crazy.
It's okay. So his name is Hatem Bazim. He is not Jewish. So let's just put this out there right now. He is not Jewish. He is the co-founder of the national, now global organization, SJP, Students for Justice in Palestine. For those of you who know, they are generally the student organization on campus that promotes BDS, that promotes this ideology that Israel is an apartheid state, that has apartheid week on college campuses. And they harass and intimidate college students all over the United States of America. So he is, you know, a co-founder. When he was at San Francisco State University, which shouldn't surprise anybody, since San Francisco State University is a university that continuously tries to invite the terrorist who the Palestinian terrorist who was involved in multiple Pan Am hijackings.
The woman. Well, I can't think of her name.
Jeez. I can't remember her name right now anyway. She's irrelevant.
Well, we know who we're talking about. Yeah. Yes.
So, you know, San Francisco State University, they keep trying to invite her to speak. Anyway, so it shouldn't be a surprise. So he was the student president in the 90s at San Francisco State University, where I guess he also founded SJP and made life miserable for Jewish students as well as for Hillel. And so he also, you know, is involved with other organizations like Kind Hearts, which is like a Hamas front group. And so he was, and I guess he's also known for being very involved with JVP, Jewish Voices for Peace, which, you know, again, the name is just like so deceptive because the founders really aren't Jewish. This is not really a Jewish voice. They don't represent the Jewish community. So JVP, he is very.
Are these the guys I saw in Washington when I was in Washington, the Hasidic looking Jews who were.
Yeah, but they're not involved with JVP. I mean,
that's not the same thing.
Yeah, no, they're like extremist Jews who just don't believe anybody should be in Israel until the Mashiach comes.
Like, but these guys in Washington were like that. They had these anti-Israeli signs.
Yeah, I know, but then
they might have been those guys. I don't know.
Yeah, no, JVP is they're not Jews. I mean, they're mostly like, you know, Palestinian and far left extremists. They are pro BDS, pro boycott. So JVP, Jewish Voices for Peace. So he often, it's reported, you know, has access to their Twitter channel and does stuff on their Twitter channel. So he was responding to something about Rashida Tlaib, obviously Rashida Tlaib, who just hosted Nakba Day at the U.S. Senate.
And Nakba, for those who don't know, is the Arab, I can't say celebration, but it's the horror that
the great catastrophe of the
when Israel came into being 75 years ago. So,
right. So is there
people who are against that celebrate Nakba? Just for those who don't know, because it's not a lot of people are aware of that.
Yeah, you need to be aware of Nakba Day, which was just celebrated at the Capitol Hill, the U.S. Senate. Rashida Tlaib was granted access via Senator Bernie Sanders, which I don't know why Senator Schumer didn't stop it, but was granted access to have her memorial remembrance of this horrific catastrophe of the founding of the State of Israel, which was also observed at the United Nations this past week. But anyway, so he was writing on the handle for JVP, and I guess he didn't realize his name was being exposed. And so he was commenting to a comment by Jake Tapper at CNN, and he started by saying, quote, as a Jew, end quote, and then he was putting his commentary. And it's like, no, you hate him. You hate Hatem Bazin. You are not a Jew. And so he is using that cover under JVP.
He went to the George Santos School of Judaism.
Right. I mean, he was using the cover of JVP to pretend like he was a Jew to support Nakba Day and Rashida Tlaib, which is just absurd. But this is like, this is so gross. I mean, this man is just, when I think about, you just stop for a moment and you think about everything that's happening all across America on every college campus via SJP. And you know, this man was the co-founder, the co-father of the founding of SJP. I mean, that should, along with Hamas, that should be an awakening, which SJP, of course, calls Hamas like a lovely social organization.
Yeah. Speaking of Hamas, they had a media tour showing how prepared they are to fight Israel.
I know you worked in media, you worked in the industry for decades, but I mean, to me, shame on the media for going and like being a part of Hamas's tour of like, let us show you all our military equipment and how we're going to destroy Israel.
Oh, but you gotta cover it. Let me give you a perfect example. I think I've told you this. I went on a Ku Klux Klan cross burning once, which was horrible. I was allowed to go with them to see how crazy these people were, and exposed as they're talking about the white man will be supreme and the Jews and the blacks and the Catholics are worthless. So it was important to do that, and that's why I think you can't blame the media for covering this to hopefully expose what goofballs these guys are. You can't blame them.
So they did it in response to Jerusalem Day in Israel, which I know we're going to play a video on Jerusalem Day. So it is a celebration in Israel. So it marks the when Jews finally were reunified, you know, when the War of Independence happened. So you have to like go back to the 1800s, early 1900s. The Old City of Jerusalem, there are more Jews living in the Old City of Jerusalem than any other ethnic group. When Israel declared independence, within the Old City, those Jews came under heavy fire and attack, and they were literally wiped out. Their entire community, their homes, the synagogues were completely ransacked and destroyed. Like, they were annihilated. And so it wasn't until we had the reunification of Jerusalem, you know, in the 67 war, where all of a sudden, like, we have access now and the ability to rebuild, which was like 19 years after the War of Independence, Jews can return and take back their homes and their land and everything. And so it's a celebration of that, you know, the reunification of Jerusalem to Israel and being able to go to the Kotel and everything else. So I have been in Israel for Jerusalem Day. I've been in the Old City. I understand the critics when they say, you know, it's you know, you shouldn't march around the Old City with flags, with Israeli flags or whatever. I'm like, well, you are in Israel and it is Jerusalem. And it's actually very joyful. I mean, it's a—
Well, did you receive any pushback when you were there from the Arab community?
Look, when you're going around the Old City, there are definitely some, but yes and no. I mean, some of the shopkeepers are like, you know, whatever, like it brings in tourists, they sell stuff. It's, you know, whatever, but it's a joyful celebration. People are dancing and they're singing and it's a very joyful thing. I do know sometimes there are confrontations. I personally didn't witness any, but what I witnessed was very joyful. Like the portions of it that I witnessed, we're joyful and celebratory, and you know, people from all different walks of life were participating, and tourists were celebrating in it. It was—
Why don't we play this piece, because it just took place this past week in Israel, and this will give you an idea of what was going on one of the holidays that most Jews don't even know about, Jerusalem Day.
It's the most controversial Jewish holiday you've never heard of. Most ultra-Orthodox Jews don't acknowledge it. Some diaspora Jews have an uneasy relationship with it. And in recent years, celebrations have significantly inflamed the tensions between Arabs and Jews. Scuffles with police, sponge rounds, riots and arrests. All while thousands of Jews flock to the streets in song and dance, celebrating the reunification of Jerusalem. So what is this holiday all about? And why does Jerusalem Day seem to draw criticism and celebration in equal measure? You're not going to find Jerusalem Day mentioned in the Tanakh, like Yom Kippur or Passover. And it's certainly not as ancient as post-biblical holidays like Hanukkah and Purim. So where did Jerusalem Day even come from? To answer that, we have to go back a few millennia. Isn't that always the case when it comes to explaining the Middle East? The bond between the land of Israel and the Jewish people is inextricable and undeniable. Well, at least if you're historically literate. And the heart of Jewish nationhood, the center of Jewish spirituality, is the ancient stone city perched upon the Judean hills. This is where ancient Jewish kings ruled, where the holy temples once stood, beckoning pilgrims from all over the world, where the Jewish people directed all their prayers during 2,000 years of exile. So yeah, Jerusalem is a pretty big deal for us Jews. And yet, it wasn't always a part of the modern Jewish state. Ownership of the city has always been a point of contention. So when the UN voted to partition Palestine into two states back in 1947, they decided to bypass the fight over the sacred real estate by placing the holy city under international control, at least at first. I'm not going to pretend that the Jews were thrilled about the prospect of the Jewish state without its spiritual capital, but Israel's founding parents were pragmatists. A Jewish state without Jerusalem as its capital was better than no Jewish state at all. So the Jews accepted the partition plan and hoped that international powers would safeguard their freedom of worship. What's that saying about the best laid plans? They get completely destroyed when your neighbors attack you? That's the saying, right? Well, the day after Israel declared independence, a number of Arab countries came to visit, with guns and tanks and rhetoric like, we're gonna push you into the sea. Yeah, they weren't crazy about their tiny new neighbor. And the two-state solution? The original plan for an international Jerusalem? That was over finished, kaput. It was all or nothing now. This was more than a fight about Israel's capital. It was a fight for Israel's very existence. And unsurprisingly, much of it centered around the ancient stone city in the Judean hills. The Jewish state emerged from a year of fighting battered and bloody, and victorious, at least partially, because Israel had won West Jerusalem. But East Jerusalem, the old city, Judaism's holiest sites, those were in Jordanian hands. Okay, you might be thinking, big deal. So the city was split, part Jewish, part Arab. Jews could still visit, right? Wrong. So wrong. Today, Jordan and Israel are allies, or at least not enemies. But back in 1948 and 49, oh boy, let's just say they were not friends. Sure, the two countries signed armistice agreements that officially ended the war of 1948. The agreements were supposed to protect Jewish access to religious and cultural sites. But the Jordanians weren't too keen on holding up their end of the bargain. First off, they expelled, killed, or imprisoned all of the Jews who had been living in East Jerusalem or the Old City. And then they went on a little spree. They desecrated graves in the ancient Mount of Olives Cemetery, hauling away tombstones for use in construction projects. They looted and tore down ancient synagogues, ravaged the Jewish quarter of the Old City where Jews, like my family, had been living for hundreds of years. Perhaps worst of all, they sealed off access to Jewish holy sites. See, Jordan didn't recognize Israeli passports as valid. Didn't matter if you were Jewish, Christian, Muslim, or any other religion. You had an Israeli passport? Sorry, no visiting the Old City for you. Once a year on Christmas, Jordan allowed Israeli Christians to visit Bethlehem. But they made no such exception for Jews who wanted to visit the Kotel. Not Yom Kippur, not Tisha B'Av, not for your kid's bar mitzvah. Never. And yeah, notice I said Jews, because under Jordanian rule, even non-Israeli Jews weren't allowed to visit the Old City. Seriously. All tourists had to show documentation proving they weren't Jewish. Pretty messed up. For 19 years, this was just how the Jewish people lived. Their country's capital was divided, their freedom of worship curtailed, and the long Jewish history of our holiest city, that was slowly being purged by Jordanians trying their best to erase history and sever the Jewish connection to Jerusalem. But then something miraculous happened. In June of 1967, the tiny Jewish state faced off against its much larger neighbors, Egypt, Jordan, and Syria. Once again, the state of Israel was under threat of extinction. And once again, Israel won. But this was no mere war for survival. Over the course of 6 days, the country more than tripled its territory. Israel won Sinai and Gaza from Egypt and the Golan Heights from Syria. But the sweetest victory came on day three, the 20th of Iyar on the Hebrew calendar, when Israeli soldiers wrested the West Bank at East Jerusalem from Jordanian control. Every Israeli knows the story of the moment that Jewish soldiers stepped onto the ancient, sacred ground they'd been unable to access for 19 years. Every Israeli can recite Commander Mota Gur's three iconic words that marked the reunification of Jewish Jerusalem. Harabait be'adenu. The Temple Mount is in our hands. In fact, my great-uncle Yoram was there that day. He hung the flag from the Western Wall, marking the miraculous moment when for the first time in almost 2,000 years, Jerusalem came back under Jewish control. Both Israel's chief rabbinate and the Israeli parliament declared the 28th of Iyar a national holiday. What does that mean exactly? Well, it means a few things. The first is exactly what you'd expect. You know, parades, celebrations, barbecues in the park, etc., etc. But there's a religious component as well. See, on certain holidays like Sukkot or Passover, observant Jews recite Hallel during morning prayers. That's a prayer, more accurately, six psalms strung together as a prayer, whose name literally translates to praise. The general concept is that we're so happy about this joyous occasion that we'll spend extra time praising God to say thanks. And since the unification of Jerusalem was both happy and religiously significant, you know, what with being able to access our spiritual capital, Israel's chief rabbinate decreed that it would not only be appropriate, but customary to say Hallel. So far, so good. So what could possibly be controversial about celebrating the reunification of your spiritual capital by saying extra prayers and holding a parade? Well, a lot. Because said sacred capital happens to be the most contested city on earth. And while the unification of Jerusalem was overall good news for the Jews, the city's Arab residents felt a little differently. So differently, in fact, that they declined Israel's offer of citizenship, instead becoming permanent residents. So what's the difference between a citizen and a permanent resident? There are a few. Like citizens, permanent residents can work and travel freely within Israel. They're entitled to healthcare and social services. They can vote in municipal elections, but they don't hold Israeli passports. They can't vote in national elections. and perhaps most importantly, they could be deported. Since 1967, thousands of East Jerusalem Arabs have applied for and received full Israeli citizenship. But while doing so used to be a big taboo in Palestinian society, it's become increasingly common. Citizens have rights and protections that non-citizens lack. In recent years, though, Israel's Interior Ministry has been slow to process applications or grant citizenship to residents of East Jerusalem, which has, unsurprisingly, led to resentment, or more accurately, added to the resentment, because many Arabs in East Jerusalem feel discriminated against by the Israeli government. So what does this all have to do with Jerusalem Day? Well, put it this way. For 19 years, the holy city was divided, enemies on both sides of the line. Today, the checkpoints and army posts are gone, but the tension is as strong as ever. Because fundamentally, you have two populations who feel that Jerusalem is theirs. And though many within those populations believe that the sacred city can be shared, others disagree. Psychologists call this zero-sum thinking, when one person's win automatically becomes the other person's loss. And zero-sum thinking doesn't exactly inspire empathy, because in a zero-sum game, if you don't win, you lose. The winner lords it over the loser. The loser seethes with barely contained resentment. But obviously, it's not that simple. And that's my point. Most people don't see Jerusalem Day as a celebration of Jewish victory over the Arabs. For most Jews, the day simply celebrates our renewed freedom to worship, our return to the historic heart of our homeland. But there's a small, vocal minority of Jews who take the celebration to a much darker place. And that is why Jerusalem Day is so controversial. It's not the extra prayers, it's not the day off, it's not the parties, it's what happens during the celebrations. Because the event that gets the most attention is the highly controversial flag march, during which thousands of Israelis march through mostly Arab areas of Jerusalem, waving Israeli flags. And while the majority of the marches are peaceful, singing and dancing and shouting slogans like Am Yisrael Chai, the people of Israel live, some are anything but. The march has erupted into violence multiple times over the past few years, as young Jews shout hateful slogans like Death to the Arabs or spray paint Jewish stars on Arab houses. And Arab residents who feel the march is a provocation often respond in kind. Despite the thousands of police officers on high alert at all times, protest scuffles and skirmishes are common, and they aren't pretty. Israeli police are equipped with stun grenades and sponge rounds, and they aren't afraid to use them against rioters or protesters. The violence isn't confined to the old city. In 2021, Hamas, the terror group that controls the Gaza Strip, threatened to shower Jerusalem with rockets if the march proceeded. And though the route was changed at the last minute, the terror group nonetheless made good on their promise, launching a barrage of rockets mere minutes into the march. Celebrants and protesters alike were forced to scatter and find shelter. It was an ugly reminder that the fight for Jerusalem isn't actually over, that tensions can boil over in seconds, and that freedom of worship, of access, of celebration, even of protest, isn't guaranteed. And that's why I think Jerusalem Day is so important. Because no matter what your beliefs, the day is both a celebration and a sobering reminder of what it means to control your spiritual destiny after 2,000 years. And of what is at stake if we ever forget.
Well, that's pretty interesting. Some people say it's like rubbing in the face of the Arab community. And I understand that.
You know, you have the Arab Christian community, and then of course you have the Muslim community. So you have, you know, you have the Jewish quarter, you have the Aramaic quarter, the Aramaic Christian quarter, and then you have the Muslim Arab quarter. Within the old city, so there's all these areas within the old city, and then there's areas where Jews can't go, and it's like a whole thing. I get it. Like, I wouldn't be marching through the Lion's Gate with the flag and
I wonder about that, and you know, it I can see where it could provoke some anger.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, but at the same time, it's also.
I can see where we would want to celebrate it. I see it from both sides, Lorene. That it's just sort of rubbing it in their face.
It's so cute. You get all these young yeshiva boys, all these cute little yeshiva boys, all come with their little kippas on, and they're all dancing and like singing, and it's a joyful day. I mean, I get both sides as well. But, you know, it's one day here and it's just for a few hours. It's not like it's every day and it's not like it's all the time, but, you know, it's one day. So, you know, whatever. Yeah, other stuff happens there that we all have to put up with. So it's like Jews can't go and pray on the Temple Mount. So
okay, let's talk about Abbas saying that the Jews have no right to the Temple Mount.
Oh.
And Netanyahu called him out, saying, "Are you crazy? Are you crazy that
I mean, they just deny, you know, 4,000 years of Jewish history and Jewish existence, and it's like, so I just want to be really clear. Muhammad came around in about the year, you know, between 600 and 700 Common Era. So about, I don't know, almost 3,000 years after Judaism, 3,000 years after Jews were in the Holy Land, were in Jerusalem, you know. So right. You've got Islam coming around. But this is also after the Romans destroyed the temple, after the Crusaders came and then slaughtered a bunch of Jews. I mean, you have all this stuff going on, and like to deny the Jewish history and the connection to Jerusalem, which is like a daily prayer for thousands of years. I mean, I don't even like, I mean.
And to have the head of the Palestinian Authority saying that we have no right to be there.
It's so aggravating. You know, look, I mean, Jews are not, by Jewish law, by Israeli law, Jews are not allowed to pray on the Temple Mount to avoid conflict. It's a massive complex. It's, you know, in some traditions, not only is it where, you know, the home of the actual Temple Mount from the Second Temple, but also in some traditions, Abraham went to go sacrifice Isaac. I mean, and there's so many stories.
There's so much history there for the Jewish religion.
Right.
It is just beyond ludicrous to say we have no right. Speaking of ludicrous, World War II, the Holocaust still is hard for, I think, most Jews to understand how man could be so cruel to man. We have an emotional piece about GIs walking into the concentration camps at the end of World War II, which ended in Europe 78 years ago this month. We'll do that after we take a break. This is The Third Opinion. Welcome back to The Third Opinion, Two Jews, Three Opinions on WKDW and the podcast. I'm Mike Deason.
I'm Lorraine Jaffe.
Yeah, World War II, as I was mentioning before the break, in Europe ended on May 8th in 1945. And I ran across a piece this week that just shook me. And you've seen it, Laureen, too. It's about the GIs who came to the concentration camps at the end of the war and seeing what they saw. I think it's one of the most emotional pieces that I've seen. What do you think, Laureen?
No, it was definitely very powerful. And it was, so Yad Vashem had put it together. You know, so Yad Vashem, for anybody who's not familiar, and if you go to Israel, you should definitely visit it. It's the Holocaust Memorial Museum in Jerusalem. And it's such a moving, moving place. I mean, it's just...
Let's take a listen to this, how the GIs reacted when they saw what was going on in the concentration camps.
Though fighting still raged in the Pacific theater, World War II in Europe officially ended with Germany's unconditional surrender on May 8, 1945. Allied armed forces advanced across Europe in the war's final stages, relentlessly pursuing the retreating German army. As they did, they stumbled onto camps, often accidentally, that had been established and run by the Nazis and their local collaborators. The Soviet army, advancing from the east, liberated Nazi camps in Poland, including Majdanek and Auschwitz. The British and Canadians, advancing from the west, liberated Bergen-Belsen and camps in northern Germany. The Americans, our focus here, liberated Dachau, Buchenwald, and other camps.
As their armies advanced across Europe, the Allies found thousands of people imprisoned in camps. They encountered piles of corpses and thousands of skeletal prisoners on the verge of death from malnutrition and disease. This was their first encounter with the horror of what would come to be known as the Holocaust. They began to understand that the Nazis had committed atrocities against civilians, the vast majority of them Jews, on an unimaginable scale, and that these atrocities were very different from the deaths caused by conventional warfare. A new category of crime had to be recognized to describe the intentional attempt to destroy a people. This crime came to be known as genocide. The soldiers were the very first outside witnesses of the Holocaust, an unprecedented case of genocide.
The testimonies of the first soldiers who entered the camps, known as the Liberators, are important eyewitness accounts of the mass atrocities committed against the Jews of Europe by the Nazis and their collaborators. Hardened combat veterans, the American GIs were used to death. Many had been fighting for years, but they had never seen killings of civilians on the massive scale they discovered. Their first encounters with Holocaust survivors at this unique moment in time give us an essential and intensely human perspective on the difference between military war and genocide.
Leon Bass was 20 years old and was among the first U.S. soldiers to arrive at Buchenwald.
I can never forget that day, because when I walked through that gate, I saw in front of me what I call the walking dead. I saw human beings that had been beaten, had been starved, had been tortured. They'd been denied everything. They had skeletal faces with deep-set eyes. Their heads had been clean-shaved, and they were standing there, and they were holding on to one another just to keep from falling. I saw the clothing of little children, the little children that didn't survive. Up against the wall, there were mounds of clothing. I saw the caps, sweaters, the stockings, the shoes, but I never saw a child.
Harry Mogan was a Jewish refugee from Nazi persecution. He reached the United States and became a soldier and a liberator.
And you saw women on the floor, on wooden pallets. When I say women, you saw skeletons, rags hanging on them, no shoes. Bones instead of faces, and the stench was so horrible. It's hard to describe.
What the American soldiers found at Ohrdruf, a subcamp of Buchenwald, was so grisly that General Dwight D. Eisenhower, then the supreme commander of the Allied Expeditionary Force in Europe, together with Generals Patton and Bradley, arrived to inspect the camp for themselves. After his visit, Eisenhower cabled,
"The things I saw beggar description. The visual evidence and the verbal testimony of starvation, cruelty, and bestiality were so overpowering as to leave me a bit sick. I made the visit deliberately in order to be in a position to give firsthand evidence of these things, if ever, in the future, there develops a tendency to charge these allegations merely to propaganda."
These words are now engraved on the wall of the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C.
Eisenhower's eyewitness testimony reveals that what he saw at Ohrdruf left a powerful impression. Eisenhower foresaw the problem of disbelief that could fuel the denial of atrocities committed by the Nazis and their collaborators. He emphasized that he purposely witnessed these horrors so that no one would later be able to deny what he saw with his own eyes. Eisenhower was convinced that the world needed to know. He made sure that members of Congress and journalists were brought to see the camp. He had all nearby soldiers whose units were not on the front lines visit as well, writing, "We are told the American soldier does not know what he is fighting for. Now, at least, he will know what he is fighting against."
U.S. Army Staff Sergeant Horace Evers was among the first Allied soldiers to enter Adolf Hitler's abandoned Munich quarters. He discovered Hitler's personal stationery. He crossed out Adolf Hitler, inserted his own name, and wrote a letter home about the camp he had seen just outside of Munich.
Dearest Mom and Lou, a railroad runs alongside the camp, and as we walked toward the boxcars on the track, I thought of some of the stories I previously had read about Dachau, and was glad of the chance to see for myself, just to prove once and for all that what I had heard was propaganda. But no, it wasn't propaganda at all. If anything, some of the truth had been held back. In 2 years of combat, you can imagine I've seen a lot of death. Furious deaths, mostly. But nothing has ever stirred me as much as this. The first boxcar I came to had about 30 what were once humans in it. Bodies on top of each other. No telling how many. And then into the camp itself, filthy barracks. How can people do things like that? I never believed they could. Until now.
As American troops approached Dachau, they saw ghastly evidence of recent mass prisoner executions. Anger led some to shoot SS guards still at the camp, but Dachau not only fueled their rage, it also aroused their compassion. Paul Parks was a 22-year-old American soldier from Indianapolis who witnessed Dachau after liberation.
These people came out of these barracks-like buildings, their striped uniforms on, and just in devastated shape. One of the fellows came out who spoke English, and he said, "Are you Americans?" And I said, "Yes." He said, "Thank God," and he hit the ground and started to pray.
Who were the people that these soldiers found? They were the victims of Nazi ideology and hatred. The Jews among them had managed to survive the Holocaust, whose goal was total annihilation. Other prisoners, including Roma, homosexuals, and communists, had managed to survive persecution and murder. For many, liberation came too late. Hundreds continued to die every day of starvation, exhaustion, and disease. But for others, the soldiers were larger than life. They represented the moment of salvation that many survivors had despaired they might not live to see.
Helen Greenbaum survived imprisonment in the Warsaw Ghetto, forced labor at a number of camps, including Majdanek and Ravensbrück, and a death march to Dachau, where she was finally liberated.
They opened all the gates, and we started some of on all four, because they let us know that the soldiers are coming. And we went out to greet the American soldiers. And we dropped to their feet, and we kissed their boots. Some of them that couldn't walk, they were just crawling. They picked up and carried them in into the camps.
Some of the soldiers broke down and cried at the sight of the survivors. Many made the conscious decision to put their military objectives temporarily on hold in order to care for the broken and dying prisoners that they found. In most cases, the liberators treated them with sympathy and kindness. After the Germans had mercilessly stripped them of their dignity, the liberators were the first to restore their humanity.
Anton Mason was about 18 when he was liberated by American soldiers at Buchenwald. He had survived Auschwitz, where most of his family was murdered.
I found out my father was dead, and I was truly at the end of my rope. I said, I don't know if I can go on. But there is something that's just impossible to explain. I just decided that I'm not going to give up. I'm going to try. And then, out of no place, on April 11, the Americans arrived. I couldn't believe it. I said, how is this possible? I walked over to a GI, a young guy, and I asked him if he could give me some food. I'm very hungry. So he took out, he gave me a Nestle bar, and he gave me a little gold envelope. It said Nescafe. I didn't know what it was. So he gave me a little food. Now, you know how much that food was worth? He could have gotten anything for it in Weimar, but he gave it to me.
Sully Gunor lay half dead in the snow after a death march from Dachau. He remembers the unshaven, tired soldier who knelt down, gently touched him on the shoulder, and said, "You're free, boy. You're free now." Sully was surprised by the soldier's Japanese features. His liberator, Clarence Matsumura, was a member of a segregated regiment of Nisei soldiers, American children of Japanese immigrants. Clarence smiled at Sully, a smile that stayed with him ever since. Sully has called Clarence his angel. Ironically, African-American GIs like Paul Parks and Leon Bass, and Japanese-Americans like Clarence Matsumura, served in segregated units in the U.S. Army. They fought for freedom and democracy, despite facing discrimination at home and within the Army. Nisei soldiers celebrated the survivors' freedom, even though racial tension and fear during the war had caused many of their own families to be interned in camps in the U.S.
For countless survivors of the Holocaust, that first contact with the liberators was the moment they began to feel safe after years of fear, loss, and rupture. But for many, liberation was the saddest moment of their lives. It was the moment they realized they were completely alone in the world. For many liberators, their first contact with the survivors was a powerful moment of insight. Trained to wage war, many chose to suspend their military missions for the humanitarian mission of giving care and respect to the survivors. The experiences of the survivors and the liberators moved many to become a moral voice, sharing their stories.
I've been trying to give testimony for a long time by just going around and speaking to people. And I think it's important that I speak about what I saw and that others speak about what they saw. Are we looking for credit? No. No one's looking for credit. No one wants a pat on the back. All we want to do is say, will this be prevented from happening again? That's the most basic thing.
Again, how people can treat people like that is just beyond me. It is just beyond me. But
it was a very, yeah, I mean, it's a very stilling.
It is.
Very just, you know, time to stop and reflect again and not forget the weightiness and the seriousness of what happened. And I can't even imagine the eyes of those who beheld what had happened.
Yeah, I thought one of the most stirring sound bites in that piece was the soldier who said, "I wanted to go there to prove all the propaganda we'd been hearing about was false. And when I saw what was going on, I realized the propaganda was mild compared to what was going on.
The truth, the reality, right.
The reality. Okay, got another controversy, making a left-hand turn. You and I are going to disagree on this, I'm sure. But Elon Musk this week stepped in it using George
Soros. Mazel tov, Elon. I don't think he was hard enough. I think he should have compared George Soros to Palpatine in Star Wars.
Wait a second. Deborah Lipstick.
When to destroy all life. I agree with Elon Musk.
It is an anti-Semitic trope, just like the Rothschilds.
Listen, no, it's not.
You may not like George Soros. Like George Soros. Anytime someone says a George Soros blah, 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 that's an anti-Semitic trope from Governor DeSantis, who says it all the time, it is an anti-Semitic trope.
I don't know why you come up with that. So actually, he made a really good point.
Deborah Lipstick. The ambassador to fight anti-Semitism said it.
Amichai Shikli, who is the czar for anti-Semitism for Israel, actually came out in support of Elon Musk. And there's a great piece that was written by Caroline Glick this week in the Jewish News Syndicate, which was also in the Allgemeiner, where she goes through in great detail. It's a very lengthy talking about Soros and how Soros for decades now has been a primary funder of organizations that are the supporters of BDS, the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanction Movement. And she went through, she listed a lot of these different organizations that he has been a primary, Al-Haq, Amazon, and others that he has funded. These are the organizations that propagate the lie that Israel is an apartheid state and everything else. And beyond that, he has spent, and I think the Forward magazine actually did this piece about 4 or 5 years ago, George Soros has spent over $2 billion propagating these organizations as well as the far left socialist movement globally. So when Elon Musk said that he is an enemy to humanity. I completely agree. And I don't think that was anti-Semitic. I don't think Elon Musk went far enough in condemning and criticizing George Soros and just how evil he is and the organizations that he funds.
It is a Jewish trope of anti-Semitism. It's a trope against Jews.
When do you ever get to criticize George Soros? I don't like him. I think he's evil. He is the number one financier of these anti-Israel evil organizations. When do I get to criticize him? I'm sorry, but we have a right to criticize him and not be anti-Semitic, which is exactly Caroline Glick's point, as well as Amichai Shikli's point, everybody else who criticizes him. George Soros hates humanity. I agree with that statement. I don't think Elon Musk went far enough. I think he should have gotten a lot farther. I think George Soros is probably one of the most wicked, evil people alive on the planet Earth today. I don't like him at all. And
well,
that's
guess what? Not everybody feels the same way, Loreen. Not everybody feels the same way.
But that's not anti-Semitic. The fact that I literally loathe
it's
this.
It's like when they said the Rothschild bankers. It's the same thing. Soros has been inserted instead of the Rothschild bankers
for
a Jewish anti-Semitic trope.
Hold on. Am I anti-Semitic because I hate him and I agree with Elon Musk?
No, but you're Jewish.
Not the same, like, but even if you're not Jewish, you should be able to criticize the man. When I look at all the organizations that he funds and what he's behind, he has evil intentions.
When they say, like, George Soros-backed prosecutors. Like,
I can't say that. That's not what
George
Elon
Soros
said.
Never gave a dime to Andrew Warren. He gave money to a group that eventually gave money to Warren.
That totally has nothing to do with Elon Musk. That's not what Elon Musk said.
No, but we're talking about George Soros. We're talking about George Soros now. It is an anti-Semitic trope whenever that is brought into the fray.
Oh,
I think.
He's awful.
We'll move on. How about one other thing before we run out of time? The woman from Israel who came in third in the Eurovision.
Noa Carell, which mazel tov to her, but I can't believe Poland's response. This is just disgusting. She
talked about the fact her whole family was pretty much killed in the Holocaust.
In Poland. Right. So the Eurovision contest, which again, it's like American Idol, but like 1,000 times bigger. It's all of Europe, the whole continent. And so she, as well as like the Near East and Middle East and everything. So she came in third on the contest this last week, Noa Carell. She's adorable Israeli. And so she made a point. From the judges from Poland, she received 12 points. And she said, quote, receiving 12 points from Poland after nearly the entire Carell family was murdered in the Holocaust, that is a victory, end quote. That's what she said. Then what happens to her? Oh my God. Like literally politicians and the main newspaper in Poland start berating her like she doesn't know anything about the Holocaust. And it says, does this statement reflect the level of education about the Holocaust in Israel? Do young people in Israel think that the Holocaust was caused by Poland, over which a young Israeli citizen can achieve a moral victory after many years, or what? End quote. Another quote. The fact that many people in Israel consider Poland to be an accomplice to German crimes and not their victim is often the result of not so much of bad will as a lack of knowledge and incomplete education. End quote. Now, okay. Yes, Poland's not Germany, but there are countless testimonies of how the Polish people.
The complicity. Yeah.
Were 100% complicit with Germans in killing the Jews. I mean, and it was the largest Jewish population in Europe. So it literally almost annihilated the entire Jewish population in the world by annihilating the Jewish population in Poland. So unbelievable.
It's crazy. It's crazy. But hear that music, Loreen?
Oh, my
we
God.
We are out of time. That's it. Thanks for joining us. This is The Third Opinion, available wherever your podcasts are available on WKDW. I'm Mike Deason.
Loreen Jaffe.
Bye.